Lanfear opened up about the events of that fateful night. He had been intimate with Mrs. Ganesh from June 1907, Ray explained. Three times at her request, he had purchased chloroform, and once he dug a hole in the hog lot for her and helped her put in the body of someone who she said had died suddenly about the house, and she thought the easiest way was to cover him up and say nothing about it. Ray insisted that he had no suspicions of Mrs. Ganesh having murdered anyone until one night when he returned suddenly from Michigan City and, having bored some holes through a wall, saw her administer some chloroform to a man and hit him in the back of the head with a hatchet. Fearing her after that, he had quit working for her and returned to the house only occasionally to get his wages still due. When Shell responded that he was not fully convinced by the story, that it was contradictory in too many particulars, Ray admitted that he had taken money from Mrs. Ganesh several times, making her shell out or he would tell on her. Once she gave him $50, at another time $15, and again $5. He would then go to saloons, and when he was sober, he would find the money all gone. On the Saturday night before the fire, he had come to her house and, reminding her that he had witnessed the Helgeline murder, demanded more hush money. She refused to give him more than $1, and he told her that he would get even with her. At Shell's prodding, Ray then went on to detail the events of the night of the conflagration. On Sunday night, after he and the negress had been drinking about 11 o'clock, the two of them went together to the Ganesh house, letting themselves in by a key which he had, and going quietly so as not to disturb another hired man who was in the house. With some of the chloroform which he had purchased for Mrs. Ganesh before Helgeline disappeared, and part of which he had kept in another bottle, the two gave Mrs. Ganesh some chloroform, holding it under her nose until she became quiet. The little boy was in bed with her. They then gave some to the two girls who were in another room. He could not explain how all were together when found. He did not know he was pretty drunk, but that was the way he remembered it. He and the negress then searched for the large sum of money which they were sure was hidden in the house, but found only a small amount. He did not set the house on fire, though he was not certain that the negress did not do it, for she was as drunk as he was. He stoutly protested that he had not arranged the candle so that it would burn down, and later set fire to the place, and that he had nothing in his mind more than to get enough money to have a big time with. He and the negress left the house together, and at a certain point in the road she went home, and he went running away, greatly afraid because he saw the house burning. After hearing Ray's statement, Shell went home and transcribed it from memory on two sheets of paper, which he showed to Ray the following day. Urged to share it with Prosecuting Attorney Smith, and save the county the cost of the trial and his sisters the expense of defending him, Ray agreed to sign it and give it to the Prosecuting Attorney. Shell then met with Smith and told him that Lanfear was going to confess. That, according to the pastor, was the end of his involvement with Lanfear. "I still feel that the communication was privileged," Shell told the Tribune reporter, "that I owed it to his sisters to refuse to make it public until now, and that the church whose minister I was at LaPorte had a right to expect silence from me, and that failure on my part to keep the confidence a secret might deter others needing an encouragement of a Christian preacher from opening his heart to some man of God." The Chicago Tribune's claim that it scored a journalistic coup with Shell's statement was greeted with scorn by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which asserted that the Tribune's ostensible scoop merely corroborated what the Post-Dispatch had already published 2 days earlier. Far from redounding to the Tribune's credit, the publication of the confession emphasizes the Post-Dispatch's motto, "First in everything." Freed from its pledge of confidentiality, the Post-Dispatch now confirmed what many had suspected all along, that its anonymous source was the Reverend Shell. In a front-page story on Saturday, January 15th, F.A. Beheimer, the reporter who had gotten the confession from Shell, gave a full account of the episode, a fascinating story of newspaper resource and enterprise that had led to this notable achievement in news gathering. Beheimer, who went to work for the paper as an 18-year-old and would remain on the staff for the next 64 years until his retirement in 1952, traveled to Shell's Iowa home on Sunday, January 9th, where he learned from the pastor's wife that her husband had gone to Adair, 200 miles up the state, to dedicate a church. Mrs. Shell said that her husband had spoken the last word about Lanphier's confession, and it would be useless to see him. Undeterred, Beheimer proceeded to Adair, where he found the pastor at a home at which he was being entertained. Following a planned line of attack, Beheimer then engaged Shell in a discussion of the crime. Sensing that the pastor thought the world ought to know the truth, but felt constrained by his pledge of confidentiality, Beheimer proceeded by indirection. Instead of asking straightforward questions, he put forth theoretical propositions about what might have occurred. Shell responded in kind, filling in details, not as one giving information, but as one suggesting theoretical explanations. "Both of us were playing parts," Beheimer explained. "I was seeking facts by asking for theories, and Dr. Shell was imparting information under the guise of hypothesis. But it was a harmless masquerade, because neither was deceiving the other, but only playing at it." Given their little charade, it was unclear to Beheimer how much of the information had been given involuntarily and how much intentionally. But it did not matter. I had the Lamphere confession, and Dr. Shell knew I had it and said so, but he asked me not to reveal the source of my information. I promised and kept the promise until Dr. Shell, by revealing the source of the information himself, released me from the obligation. Questioned by reporters following the publication of Shell's statement, Wirt Worden responded with a snort. "I went to see Lamphere in jail immediately upon hearing that he had been talking with Dr. Shell," Worden explained. "I asked him if he had confessed. Lamphere was holding the Bible given to him by Dr. Shell, and standing there with his hand on the book, he laughed and said he would never tell the clergyman anything he wouldn't tell me. He then repeated what he had told the preacher. It was the same story he clung to all through the case, absolutely denying that he had killed Mrs. Ganess or set her house on fire. Lamphere insisted that was all he told the pastor." A local physician, interviewed by the La Porte Argus Bulletin, was equally dismissive. "Shell's story," he said, "was the most ridiculous thing I ever saw in print. No matter how deep might have been their sleep, it's impossible that Lamphere and the Negress could have chloroformed Mrs. Ganess and her three children without awakening them. And if Mrs. Ganess had been awakened, there would have been screaming, and Maxim would have heard it." Prosecuting Attorney Smith was of a different opinion. "I know it's authentic," he said about Shell's statement. "There are remarks in the story which Shell made to me after his talks with Lamphere, quoted exactly." Even so, there was one element of the confession that Smith questioned. "Shell told me to arrest a certain negress," Smith told reporters. "He didn't tell me why, but now I know. In my opinion, however, Lamphere lied to Shell when he told that this colored person went to the Ganass house with Lamphere and assisted him in the murder of the woman and her children. I think this person helped plan the thing, but she was too wise a girl to go to the house with Lamphere and assist in the execution." 41. The Skull. The negress referred to in Shell's statement was, of course, Elizabeth Smith, Nigger Liz, as her neighbors had no compunctions about calling her. Immediately following the publication of Ray's reported confession on Saturday, January 15, 1910, she was arrested at home on the order of Judge Richter and subjected to a four-hour sweating at the county jail. She admitted that Ray had spent part of the night of April 27th at her home, but fiercely denied that she had accompanied him to the Ganess house or had anything to do with the fire. She was then released on a $500 bond. She was expected to give grand jury testimony the following Thursday, January 22nd, but failed to appear. She was sick at home, the newspapers reported, and her physicians say she may not be able to undergo an inquisition for weeks. Worry over her position in the affair and the action of the authorities has made her seriously ill. She was still prostrated on February 4th, and unable to appear before the grand jury that had been called to examine her, 1 month later, on Saturday, March 5th, State's Attorney Smith announced that, owing to the lack of tangible evidence on which to hold her for trial, the decision had been reached to drop the case against Elizabeth Smith for alleged complicity in the crimes committed at the Ganesse farm. That same day, Wirt Warden had his own announcement to make, telling reporters that there would be sensational developments shortly in connection with the Ganesse case, ones that confirmed his long-held belief that she is alive. The big news promised by Warden broke the following day. Belle Ganesse had been located in Grand Rapids, Michigan, identified by a local police officer, Lewis Richmond. This woman has, by her peculiar actions, caused at least three others to suspect that she is Mrs. Ganesse, declared Richmond, who immediately wrote to Sheriff Anderson LaPorte, urging him to send a deputy to the Michigan City to arrest the woman. This announcement was greeted with widespread and well-justified skepticism. Just 2 months earlier, in January, papers throughout the Midwest had trumpeted the news that Belle had been arrested in Wilmar, Minnesota, where she was working under an alias as housekeeper for a farmer named Gus Kirby. In mid-February, word came from Washington State that the arch-murderess had been found on a ranch 16 miles from Bellingham by United States Marshal Andrew Williams. As in both these previous instances, the Michigan story proved to be false, the woman in question having been identified as Belle for no better reason than that she was a Norwegian and had inserted advertisements in Norwegian newspapers seeking a husband. Despite these repeated mirages, sightings of LaPorte's Lucretia Borgia would continue unabated. Before the year was out, she would be reported as living in Moscow, Idaho, Greenville, Illinois, Palouse, Washington, and Galkin, Oklahoma, where she was ostensibly cohabitating with a man who is the possessor of a fur coat, two revolvers, two rifles, and two shotguns. Each of these supposed discoveries was scrupulously investigated by LaPorte authorities at the behest of State's Attorney Smith. Though Smith remained convinced that Belle was dead, he insisted on running down every lead, intent on proving that every clue brought up by those who cling to the belief that Mrs. Ganesse is alive is without foundation. Wirt Warden, one of those who clung most tenaciously to that belief, got a seemingly significant boost in December 1912, when a prisoner named Harry Myers, doing time in the Michigan City Penitentiary, came forward with a startling story. A convicted burglar and horse thief, Myers had been put to work in the prison and, while nursing and dying Ray Lamphere, had obtained, so he claimed, a deathbed statement from Ray. According to Myers, Ray insisted that Belle Ganesse was alive. The headless adult body found in the ruins was that of a Chicago woman brought to the Ganesse farm as a housekeeper and poisoned a few days later. She was then decapitated to make identification almost impossible. Her head, wrapped in a piece of carpet and placed inside a wooden box containing three other heads, two of them that looked as if they had been dead some time, was given to Lamphere, who buried it in a field of rye. Belle had killed her three children, also with poison, to keep them from talking about all the male visitors who had vanished so mysteriously. On the night of the conflagration, Ray had driven Belle in a two-seated rig drawn by a pony to a point 9 miles from LaPorte, where another man whom he did not know met her and drove her to Chicago. She was carrying two large valises and a small basket. In the basket was a box made of tin containing a large pile of paper money, the smallest denomination being $100 bills. After he delivered Mrs. Ganesse to the other man, Ray returned to the Ganesse farm and set fire to the house in which were the bodies of the Chicago woman and three children. For his work, he received $500. Myers's widely publicized revelation brought a new flood of reported sightings. Within 2 weeks, at least 20 Mrs. Ganesses had been seen in different parts of the country and reported to police. Most of these tips were so patently implausible that LaPorte authorities paid no attention to them. One, however, a telegram from police in Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada, claiming that the notorious fugitive was living in a small mining village 10 miles away, was taken seriously enough that the LaPorte police chief, William Meinke, was dispatched to Lethbridge to confirm her identity. The woman in question, according to information conveyed by a Norwegian miner named Forland, weighed about the same as Mrs. Guinness and is of the same age. She has three trunks kept securely locked in her basement that correspond to those which were told about by witnesses at the time the murders were discovered. Forland also claimed that he was in possession of a letter written to the woman, which commenced with the words, "Dear Bell." Mikey's trip up north, however, proved to be in vain. He returned to LaPorte on January 27, 1913, and announced that the woman is not Mrs. Guinness. Shortly before 5 p.m. on Friday, March 17, 1916, Elizabeth Smith, the only person in the world who might have lifted the veil of mystery from the Guinness case, died at the home of a friend. No one, including herself, knew her exact age, though, as she told the doctor who attended her in her final illness, she suspected it was pretty near 80. A few days earlier, while lying on her cot beside the stove in the only habitable room of her tumble-down shack on Pulaski Street, an errant spark set the mattress on fire. Neighbors, hearing her screams, rushed to her aid and, after swiftly extinguishing the fire, carried her to her friend's home. Though the burns she suffered weren't life-threatening, the shock of the experience, combined with her frail physical condition, proved too much for the aged negress. Knowing that her end was near, Smith asked to see Wirt Wharton. Over the years, she had promised him repeatedly that, when she knew she was dying, she would tell him everything she knew of Belle Guinness and the murder farm. As luck would have it, however, Wharton was in Louisiana on a business matter. By the time he got back to LaPorte, Elizabeth Smith was in the ground. In announcing her death, newspapers recounted the salient facts of her life. Her childhood spent with her widowed mother, an ex-slave known as Granny Olmsted, who lived to be a 104 and claimed to have known George Washington. Her marriage to a Union Army cook, who died early, leaving her with a federal pension of $24 a month. Her own shrewdness as a businesswoman that allowed her to acquire six houses and a savings account of several thousand dollars. And, of course, her youthful reputation as a colored beauty who had dazzled many a white man. In the latter years of her life, Smith, like many old people, had become what we now call a compulsive hoarder. A newspaper man visiting her shack sometime after her death was shocked at its condition. "There are tons and tons of rubbish in the old shack," he reported. "The front door was piled high with rubbish of all kinds, all absolutely valueless. The floor was covered several feet deep with papers, broken lamps, chairs, benches, tin cans, bits of window screen, rags, and filth and dirt of every kind and description. Rubbish was piled high around the little stove in one room, where she was finally compelled to live because all the others were so full of rubbish. Her coal ashes were dumped on the floor by the stove." The shack being beyond salvation, plans were made to tear it down and sell the lumber, studs, and sheathing. A man named Andrew Harness was retained to clean the place out and demolish it. Eventually, he would sell nearly 1,000 pounds of rags and scrap metal to local junk dealers and cart 20 wagon loads of refuse to the town dump. On Friday, May 5th, while rummaging about in the knee-deep debris of Smith's shack, Harness turned up a human skull, a musty, cobwebby relic, missing its lower jaw and with only a few rotted roots to mark the upper set of teeth. Newspapers throughout the country immediately announced a possible solution to the Guinness mystery. Should the skull prove to be Bell's, its discovery would confirm one widely held theory, that Ray Lamphere and Elizabeth Smith, his black paramour, murdered Mrs. Guinness and her children, dragged the bodies to the cellar, and then severed the head of Mrs. Guinness from the body so that it might not be identified and suspicion fall upon her for the deed. Alternatively, wrote the Chicago Tribune, if experts can prove that the skull found in the shack of Nigger Liz fits that of the torso found, then it may be established that Mrs. Guinness escaped the fire. The excitement provoked by Harness's find, however, was exceedingly short-lived. Within 24 hours, doctors examining the skull declared that it was at least 40 years old, while neighbors of Smith's affirmed that it had been in her possession long before she knew there was such a woman as Belle Guinness. Smith, it seemed, was what the newspapers quickly labeled a voodoo doctor who used the skull to conjure with. "My mother, she's dead now," said one of Smith's acquaintances, "but she often told me about how she'd see Nigger Liz sitting up at night with the light shining through the holes in the skull, and Nigger Liz, she'd sit and read to it out of the Bible." Others testified that it was Smith's custom to write the names of those persons upon whom she wished to work a malicious charm upon the skull and go through her mysterious ceremonies over the pencil marks. There were, in fact, a number of names inscribed in pencil on the cranium of the skull, one of which, Phil Bungers, appeared to refer to a long-retired LaPorte police officer, Phil Bungers, whom Smith hated most fiercely. Unconstrained by anything as banal as verifiable fact, the Chicago Tribune proclaimed that Smith, a known voodooist, a worker of charms and incantations, was a friend of Mrs. Ganesse and often visited her. Papers dug from the dirt in her shack lead to the belief that she may have engaged in the same practices as Mrs. Ganesse, or may even have been the latter's mentor in crime. There are letters containing proposals of marriage from men she evidently got into communication with through marriage newspapers. There are recipes for weird charms and love filters, and papers on hypnotism and clairvoyance. Then there is the question of how she obtained enough money to acquire almost a whole block of LaPorte property, as well as a comfortable bank account. Was the money obtained in the same way as Mrs. Ganesse, or did she share in the latter's wealth for some part she played in helping fill the graves on the death farm? The source of the skull would never be determined, though one individual came forward with a colorful, if highly dubious, explanation. His name was C.F. Russell, a Barnum-esque character who ran a traveling show that toured the army outposts of the western frontier. Russell claimed that 25 years earlier, Elizabeth Smith had been suffering from a tumor in the abdomen and had consulted an old dark mammy who provided her with a surefire cure, a magical incantation to be recited while rubbing the skull of a murderer. Rub-a-dub-dub-dub. Murderer's skull to rub, and fair or foul or foul or fair, you can have it as you care. As it happened, Russell himself was in possession of just such a skull. A former member of the 7th Cavalry under General George Armstrong Custer, or so he claimed, Russell had been wounded in a fight with Sitting Bull's men and discharged for disability. As a result, he was not with his regiment at the Little Bighorn Massacre. During one of his subsequent tours out west, he visited the battlefield where my comrades had been wiped out and discovered the skull of a chief, which he kept as a souvenir. Somehow Smith learned that he was in possession of the skull and, figuring that nobody was more of a murderer than the Indians who killed Custer and all those soldiers, she sought out Russell and begged to borrow the skull. "I'd never heard of her," Russell told his interviewer, "but she promised to return it, and so I gave her the skull." When he went to retrieve it about a year later, however, she told him that it had been stolen. "I had no reason to believe she wasn't telling the truth," explained Russell, "so I let the relic go." Though some newspapers persisted in reporting that the skull might yet provide a key to the famous Ganesse case, most agreed that Elizabeth Smith had taken the secrets of the murder farm to the grave. Wirt Warden expressed particular frustration. "I knew of Ray's friendship with the old woman, and tried my best to get her to talk," he told one reporter. "If only I hadn't been away when Liz died, the whole mystery would have been solved by now." 42. Mrs. Carlson. Throughout the years, anyone connected with the Ganesse story was likely to find his name in the newspapers. In January 1915, Joe Maxson, the last of Bell's handymen and survivor of the farmhouse fire, was arrested by LaPorte police, charged with beating his wife and threatening to kill her and their children. 8 years later, on October 31, 1923, he died on the job at the Indiana Molding Company, fatally struck on the head by a piece of falling lumber. The following year, a nephew of Bell's, 26-year-old Adolph Ganesse, was much in the news. An ex-soldier who had been gassed and shell-shocked in the Great War, Adolph was a patient at the Speedway Hospital for Disabled Veterans in Chicago, where he met and began a romance with a nurse named Anna Furness. They were married on July 20, 1923. Several months later, he absconded with $1,400 of her money and fled to Madison, Wisconsin, where, it turned out, he had another wife, the former Ella Mathewson, to whom he had been wed in 1920. Arrested and brought back to Chicago, he was convicted of bigamy and sentenced to 1 to 5 years in the Joliet Penitentiary. In late 1930, a Russian immigrant named John A. Nepsha, who had arrived in La Porte 2 years after the Gonesse affair, purchased the former murder farm and began constructing a house where Bell's home once stood. Nepsha, newspapers reported, laughed at the superstitions which have kept the property vacant for the last 2 decades. He thinks so little of such ghost stories that he plans to make a garden in the graveyard which yielded body after body of the woman's victims. Confirming in the view of some Laportians that the place was accursed, Nepsha became embroiled in a bitter divorce proceeding a few years later, and eventually filed suit asking Judge Russell W. Smith to partition between himself and his former wife 7 tracts of land totaling 64 acres and including the Gonesse farm. Sporadic sightings of Mrs. Gonesse were reported over the next 20 years. The Vamp Slayer, as she was now dubbed in the press, was spotted in Colorado, Canada, Mississippi, New York. When, in 1928, Los Angeles detectives discovered that a string of missing boys had been molested and slain at a chicken ranch in the nearby community of Wineville, speculation ran high that Belle Gonesse, recently reported as living in California, was somehow connected to the horrors. The continuing failure of these supposedly promising leads did nothing to shake Wirt Worden's conviction that Belle was still alive. He was totally convinced by the deathbed confession that Ray Lamphere had supposedly made to Harry Myers, and that was published in its entirety for the first time in July 1930. Worden never abandoned the hope that the multi-murderess would someday be apprehended. And in the spring of 1931, that hope finally seemed to be fulfilled. On the night of February 9, 1931, Peter H. Lindstrom, a Chicago meatpacker, received a telephone call informing him that his father, August, had died suddenly late that afternoon at his home in the Los Angeles suburb of Lomita. On the face of it, there seemed nothing suspicious about the elder Lindstrom's death. A retired lumber dealer and former resident of Williams, Arizona, Lindstrom was 82 years old, a ripe age at any time, and especially in a day when the life expectancy of a U.S. male born in the mid-1800s was less than 50. Still, the news came as a shock to Peter. Just one day earlier, he had received a letter from his father, who declared that he was feeling fine and expected to live to be 100 years old. August's body was transported to the Stone and Myers funeral home, where the deputy chief coroner signed the death certificate, ascribing the cause to heart failure. The remains were then shipped to Williams, Arizona, where they were interred on February 11th. A few days after the funeral, Peter traveled to Los Angeles to look more closely into the circumstances of his father's death and take care of the old man's estate. His first stop was the home of Mrs. Esther Carlson, the 62-year-old widow who had worked as August's housekeeper for the past 15 years. Mrs. Carlson's late husband, Charles, had been close friends with August, their bond having been forged years earlier when Lindstrom was the superintendent of a logging camp near Williams and Carlson the proprietor of a local saloon. One day, after firing a gang of Mexican workers and replacing them with a bunch of his fellow Swedes, Lindstrom, according to newspaper accounts, was attacked by the Mexicans on the main street of Williams. Breaking free, he ran into Carlson's saloon with the Mexicans at his heels. Carlson, standing behind the bar, drew a revolver and killed 3 of the Mexicans. From that point on, the 2 men had been almost inseparable companions. They were neighbors in Hemet, California, when Carlson died after a prolonged illness in 1925. Soon after, Lindstrom moved to Lomita, taking the widow Carlson with him as his housekeeper. Now, conferring with Mrs. Carlson, Peter Lindstrom learned that, on the afternoon of February 9th, she had telephoned a local physician, Jesse A. Lancaster, and informed him that Lindstrom was violently ill. Dr. Lancaster instructed her to come to his residence, where he gave her a powder for the patient. About a half hour later, she phoned again and stated Lindstrom was dying. Dr. Lancaster went to the home and found Lindstrom dead. The story struck Peter as odd. His suspicions were raised to an even higher pitch when he discovered something else. A week before his father's death, Mrs. Carlson had arranged with the Lomita branch of the California Bank to make Lindstrom's $2,000 account a joint account for herself and her employer. No sooner had August been buried than a close friend of hers, 42-year-old Mrs. Anna Erickson, appeared at the bank with a letter of authority from Mrs. Carlson and withdrew the entire sum. Peter immediately shared his suspicions with his brother Charles, a state highway official in Williams. On Wednesday, February 18th, August's body was exhumed and taken by train back to Los Angeles, arriving early Thursday. That same morning, Esther Carlson and Anna Erickson were brought in for questioning by Captain William Bright of the sheriff's homicide detail. Afterward, the two women repaired to Mrs. Carlson's place for coffee. Early Friday, following the autopsy on August Lindstrom, the county chemist, R.A. Abernathy, reported to Deputy District Attorney George Stallman that he had found 2.5 grains of arsenic in Lindstrom's stomach, enough to kill 40 men, along with a quantity of split-pea soup. Warrants for the arrest of Esther Carlson and Anna Erickson on a charge of suspicion of murder were immediately issued. By then, however, Erickson had been stricken with violent convulsions and rushed to General Hospital. When her stomach was pumped and the contents analyzed by Abernathy, the county chemist, he discovered that she had ingested a strong dose of arsenic. Doctors expressed little hope of her survival. It was shortly after midnight when Esther Carlson was taken into custody. Under questioning by Captain Bright and Deputy D.A. Stallman, she remained tight-lipped about Lindstrom. As for Erickson, all she would say was, "She got me into this." Defying the dire predictions of her physicians, Anna Erickson not only survived, but felt strong enough by Sunday, February 22nd, to point the finger of guilt at Mrs. Carlson. Speaking to Stallman from her hospital bed, Erickson claimed that, about 3 weeks before August Lindstrom's death, Carlson had told her that she couldn't stand him any longer and wished he was out of the way. Lindstrom had also been talking of giving up his home and going back to Williams, Arizona to live with his son Charles, a move that would have left his longtime housekeeper without a job. 2 days later, on Tuesday the 24th, Stallman took another written statement from Anna Erickson, who leveled even more incriminating charges against her former friend. As the deputy DA told reporters following this second bedside interview, Erickson claimed that Mrs. Carlson had often remarked that she was sick of taking care of old men. She said that Mrs. Carlson had made this statement not only in referring to Lindstrom, but to her husband, Charles Carlson, and another man, both of whom are reported to have died in Hemet in 1925 within a short time of each other. The other man, as newspapers soon revealed, was an 80-year-old Swedish immigrant named Gustav Olsen. Soon after arriving in this country, Olsen fell ill and was taken into the home of the Carlsons, then living in Hemet, California. A doctor was summoned, who diagnosed the problem as heart disease and prescribed a then-common drug for the condition, strychnine tablets, to be taken one at a time as needed. A short time later, however, Olsen was found dead. It was generally accepted that he had taken the entire box of tablets at once, the Los Angeles Times reported, either by accident or with suicidal intent. Some months later, Charles Carlson died, reportedly of stomach cancer. Thanks to Anna Erickson's latest accusations, however, Deputy D.A. Stallman announced plans to travel to Hemet to look into the deaths of both men. That same Tuesday, beginning at 11 a.m., an inquest was held into August Lindstrom's death at the county morgue. Along with the dead man's two sons, witnesses included county chemist Abernathy, undertaker Charles Myers, B.A. Peckham, the bank manager who had turned over the $2,000 to Anna Erickson at Esther Carlson's written order, and Deputy Sheriff Harry Brewster, who testified that he had found an empty strychnine bottle in a sewing bag belonging to Mrs. Carlson. Carlson herself refused to testify on the advice of her attorney. Erickson, who had just been discharged from the hospital, was there too. After initially declining, she agreed to testify. Aided by another deputy sheriff, Hazel Brown, she tottered to the witness stand where she admitted that she had given Lindstrom a piece of apple pie on the morning of his death, but declared that she had given another neighbor a piece of the same pie. The coroner's jury was unpersuaded by her professions of innocence. though ruling that Lindstrom died from poison, administered with homicidal intent by a person or persons unknown to us, they recommended that Mrs. Esther Carlson and Mrs. Anna Erickson be held pending further action in this case. That evening, immediately following the all-day inquest, Stallman issued murder charges against the pair. The next morning, shortly after their arraignment, Stallman left for Hemet, where he discovered that Esther Carlson had purchased a quantity of poison from a local pharmacist in 1922. Inspecting the medical records of Gustav Alsen, he learned that, though the old man's death was officially ascribed to natural causes, the same symptoms as in arsenic poisoning were present before he died. Stallman was also told of unverified reports indicating that strychnine poisoning may have caused Charles Carlson's death. Before returning home that night, the deputy DA announced to reporters that the bodies of both men may be exhumed. On the first Monday of March, another pharmacist, L.L. Willis of Long Beach, who had been following the case in the newspapers, came forward to report that, a month earlier, Mrs. Carlson and her friend had attempted to purchase arsenic from him. Suspicious of their motive, he declined to make the sale. His disclosure prompted police to make another search of Carlson's home, where they found a piece of stationery inscribed with a recipe for ant poison. 3 cupfuls of sugar in jar, 2 cupfuls boiling water on sugar, add 2 teaspoons of sodium of arsenite. Put in little cans. Deputy D.A. Stallman immediately declared his intention to show the formula to numerous druggists in Los Angeles, Long Beach, Redondo, and other nearby towns in an effort to ascertain whether or not the women used it as a pretext for purchasing sodium of arsenite. That Friday, the preliminary hearing was held in municipal court. By then, Anna Erickson was fully recovered. It was Esther Carlson who appeared desperately weak and unsteady, the result, as newspaper readers were informed, of an advanced case of pulmonary tuberculosis. County chemist Abernathy was the first to take the stand, testifying that Lindstrom's body was saturated with arsenic. Lindstrom's son, Charles, described the suspicions that had led him to have his father's body exhumed and returned to California for examination by the coroner. Mrs. Carlson told me that my father came home ill one day, refused to eat lunch, and was violently sick during the afternoon, Charles told the jury. She said that he refused to allow her to call a doctor. She finally did so about 7 p.m. when his condition grew much worse, but he was dead when the physician arrived. The physician in question, Dr. Jesse A. Lancaster, told of giving Mrs. Carlson medicine for Lindstrom on the day of his death. He confirmed that when he arrived at Lindstrom's home shortly after 7 that evening, the old man was dead. "Several days afterwards," he continued, "I was called to attend Mrs. Erickson, who was ill. I found her sick and vomiting, and administered treatment, removing her to the hospital. A chemical test of the contents of her stomach showed arsenic. She told me she became ill after drinking part of a cup of coffee which Mrs. Carlson gave her." At the close of the hearing, Judge H. Parker Wood ordered that both women be held for trial on charges of murder. Denying their lawyer's request, he refused to release them on bail. 3 weeks later, the defendants pleaded not guilty when brought before Superior Judge William C. Duran, who ordered them to go to trial on April 30th in Department 3 of Superior Court. Before that date arrived, however, something happened that propelled Esther Carlson, up until then a figure of strictly local notoriety, onto the front pages of newspapers around the country and touched off a controversy that would resonate for the next 70 years. Besides the recipe for ant poison, police had found something else of interest during their second search of Esther Carlson's home, a battered trunk containing an old photograph of 2 little girls and a boy. Exactly how the photo came to be shown to Mrs. Mary Kruger of Huntington Park is unclear. What is certain is that Mrs. Kruger, a former resident of LaPorte, who claimed to have known the Ganesse family well, positively identified the children as Belle's son Philip and her daughters Myrtle and Lucy. Informed of this startling fact, Deputy D.A. Stallman and his boss, Byron Fitz, immediately let it be known that they were launching an investigation into the possibility that Esther Carlson was the notorious Mrs. Ganesse. Throughout the nation, headlines trumpeted the dramatic development. L.A. woman may be famous murderess. Slayer in Los Angeles may be Belle Ganesse. Mrs. Carlson called Murder Farm Woman. Newspapers ran side-by-side photographs of the two women, the famous formal portrait of the glowering, moon-faced female Bluebeard, and various shots of the scarecrowish Mrs. Carlson, who, allowing for the passage of years and the ravages of disease, might well have been an old, emaciated belle. In the 23 years since the Gunness horrors came to light, sightings of the multi-murderess had averaged one a month, according to the Los Angeles Times. Of all those Gunness suspects, the paper reported, Mrs. Carlson appears to be the hottest. Confined to her bed in the prison ward of the county hospital, Mrs. Carlson, whose condition had taken a marked turn for the worse, denied, with all the vigor she could muster, that she was Belle Gunness. Interviewed by Stallman, she asserted that her maiden name was Johnson. Born in Sweden in 1867, she emigrated to America in 1892 at the age of 25, and for the next 17 years worked as a housemaid for the Asa V. Cook family of Hartford, Connecticut. In 1907, she married a Hartford man, Charles Hansen. Just 9 months later, her new husband drowned in the Agawam River near Springfield, Massachusetts. In 1909, she came to Los Angeles and soon afterward moved to Williams, Arizona, where, in 1911, she met and married Charles Carlson. Following his death in 1925, she moved back to Los Angeles. She insisted she had never lived in Indiana or, indeed, ever set foot in the state. Authorities were unconvinced. Mrs. Gunness dropped from sight in 1908, Stallman said, and with Sheriff McDonald of LaPorte and the authorities in Connecticut and Massachusetts, we shall investigate those 17 years she says she spent in the employ of the Cook family. In LaPorte, where, as newspapers reported, the populace had been whipped into a state of high excitement by the possibility that the ogress had finally been found, Sheriff Tom McDonald expressed his doubts about the dying woman's denials. If Mrs. Carlson was not Mrs. Gunness, the case is the strangest one could imagine because so many details dovetail, he declared. The ages, the nationalities, and many of the racial features, the fact that each woman had three children, two girls and a boy, with ages corresponding and, from pictures, with similar features, these things are responsible for my strong feeling that Mrs. Carlson may be Mrs. Gunness. Besides sending Stallman photographs and a detailed physical description of Belle, McDonald promptly contacted two men, former residents of LaPorte, currently living in the Los Angeles area. John Dennis Daly, a 70-year-old boilermaker, a neighbor of Belle's between 1902 and 1908, who had met and talked with her hundreds of times, and John A. Yorkie, a one-time LaPorte saloonkeeper, who had often seen her around town. On Thursday, May 7, 1931, bearing introductory telegrams from Sheriff McDonald, Daly and Yorkie appeared in Stallman's office and were immediately taken to view Esther Carlson in the hope that they could settle the question of her true identity. By then, however, Esther Carlson was dead. She succumbed to her illness on Wednesday, May 6th, a week after Anna Erickson went on trial for August Lindstrom's murder. Learning from doctors that Mrs. Carlson had only a few hours to live, Stallman had rushed to her bedside, accompanied by Anna Erickson's defense attorney, Joseph Marchetti, hoping that at the last Carlson would clear up the mystery of August Lindstrom's death. Stallman bent close to the semi-conscious woman's ear and asked if she had poisoned Lindstrom. A barely audible sound, variously described as a mumble, sigh, and croak, escaped her lips. Stallman thought it sounded like yes. "You admit you gave him arsenic?" he asked. She answered with the same muffled sound. Satisfied that Carlson had made a deathbed confession, Stallman stepped aside, and Marchetti took his place. "Mrs. Carlson," the lawyer asked, "you mean you did not kill Mr. Lindstrom, don't you?" When she emitted the very same sound, Stallman, letting out a sigh of his own, was forced to concede that the dying woman had no idea what she was being asked. A few hours later, as newspapers reported, death sealed her lips forever. Her body was removed to the county morgue to await transport to Hemet for burial. Driven to the morgue by Stallman, Dennis Daly and John Yorkie each spent about 40 minutes viewing the corpse. Afterward, speaking to reporters, Daly declared that he was positive that the dead woman was Belle Gunness. "I haven't the slightest doubt about it," he said. "She had a peculiar twist to her mouth that was very noticeable. Her eyes are the same color. Her hair, although faded by age, is the same general color and texture. The cheekbones are high, too. The height of the woman is the same. The last time I saw Mrs. Ganesh, she was rather heavy, but the tuberculosis could have worn the body down through the years." John Yorkie was equally emphatic in his identification. On Monday, May 11th, the same day that Esther Carlson was laid to rest in Valley Cemetery beside her second husband, Charles, Yorkie sent a letter to Wirt Warden. "I am sorry I did not go and see her while alive," he wrote. "But you can bet all you got that was Belle Ganesh of the old murder farm." 43. The Mystery of Iniquity. Wirt Warden died of a heart attack in January 1943, at the age of 69. For the last 8 years of his life, he had been a judge in the LaPorte Circuit Court and had played a small part in the notorious case of D.C. Stevenson, former Grand Dragon of the Indiana branch of the Ku Klux Klan, whose conviction for the murder of a young woman, Madge Oberholzer, dealt a death blow to the Klan's growing political influence in the state. In recalling Warden's accomplishments, however, newspaper obituaries gave greatest prominence to his role in the Ganesh case and his successful defense of Ray Lamphere on the murder charge. Warden never abandoned his belief that Belle had escaped, though whether he accepted John Yorkie's confident assertion is unknown. In any event, another 80 years would pass before proof emerged that Yorkie was wrong. In 2014, Knut Erik Jensen, a native of Selbu, Norway, Belle's birthplace, embarked on a research mission to settle the question of Esther Carlson's true identity. After consulting census books, cemetery records, city directories, and various other documents, he definitively established that the story the dying Carlson told about her background was true in every detail. She was not Belle Ganesh. In my previous book, Maneater, about the 19th-century Colorado cannibal and convicted mass murderer Alfred Packer, whose guilt or innocence remains a matter of heated dispute, I referred to the innate human need for what psychologist Ari Kruglansky was the first to label cognitive closure, which he defined as the individual's need for a firm answer to a question and aversion to ambiguity. The sheer popularity of detective stories, a genre first brought to life in Edgar Allan Poe's The Murders in the Rue Morgue, is testimony to the power of this basic psychological hunger, our deep-seated longing to arrive at, or be provided with, tidy solutions to vexing puzzles. In contrast, of course, to the seemingly impossible riddles neatly unraveled by the ratiocinative genius of C. Auguste Dupin, or a Sherlock Holmes, or a Hercule Poirot, real life often presents us with criminal mysteries that stubbornly, even maddeningly, resist solution. Foremost among these is the identity of Jack the Ripper, and the regular appearance of books promising the long-sought revelation suggests just how difficult it is for us to tolerate the unknowable. Other cases shrouded in uncertainty that continue to elicit purported solutions include those of Lizzie Borden, the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, and most recently, the JonBenet Ramsey murder. Though less well known nowadays than these others, the Ganesh case continues to attract the fascinated attention of crime buffs. In 2008, for example, a pair of forensic anthropologists, after exhuming the remains from Chicago's Forest Home Cemetery, employed DNA analysis in an attempt to determine if the headless body was that of Mrs. Ganesh. The results were inconclusive. When I embarked on this project, I fantasized that my own research might produce a solution of the century-old mystery. At one point, I believed I had stumbled on an exciting lead, a newspaper clipping revealing that Ganesh had sometimes placed her matrimonial advertisements under the pseudonym Belle Hinckley. Further digging led to the discovery that a woman by that name was residing in Wisconsin in 1915. I thought I might be onto something, but my excited hopes were quickly dashed when it turned out that there was absolutely no connection between the two Bells. My next hope was that by the time I finished writing my book, I would arrive at some relatively firm conclusion about precisely what happened on the night of the Ganes fire. To my chagrin, I must now confess to failure even on that far more modest score. After several years of being deeply immersed in every detail of the Ganes case, I am unable to venture even an informed opinion on the matter. To be sure, Lamphere's reported confession to the Reverend Shell strikes me as highly implausible. Beyond that, however, various possibilities seem equally credible to me. That Belle staged her own death and escaped, that she died in a fire deliberately set by Ray, or that she immolated herself and her children in a final act of suicidal desperation. An editorial published in the Cleveland Plain Dealer following the horrific discoveries on the murder farm has proved to be prescient. The LaPorte case may always remain one of the most puzzling things in the annals of crime. I trust that, at the very least, my reconstruction of the crime will allow readers to arrive at their own opinions about the mystery of Belle Ganes's ultimate fate. Of course, there is a deeper mystery at work here. What kind of woman, what kind of person, could commit the kind of atrocities perpetrated by Belle Ganes? To be sure, other female psychopaths have killed at least as many victims. Just 7 years before the Ganes horrors came to light, Jolly Jane Toppin, a respected and popular New England nurse, confessed to 31 murders, making her America's most prolific serial murderer before John Wayne Gacy. Earlier women poisoners like Lydia Sherman and Sarah Jane Robinson, American Borgias as they were called, subjected husbands, siblings, and their own children to slow, agonizing deaths by arsenic. What distinguished Belle from her homicidal predecessors, however, indeed what makes her a unique figure in the annals of female criminality, at least in our nation, is the butchery she performed on her victims, the desecration of their corpses, hacked to pieces, and dumped in the muck of her hog lot. Reducing other people to subhuman status is the very essence of evil, and students of her crimes have struggled to account for its origins in Belle. The vicious assault she ostensibly suffered in adolescence that ignited her hatred of men, the pathological greed that transformed her into a bluebeard with a profit motive, these and other theories clearly cannot begin to explain evil on the scale of the Ganes horrors, confronting us with a mystery far more profound than the question of whether she survived the fire. What the Bible calls the mystery of iniquity. I leave the last words on the subject to the editor of the LaPorte Weekly Herald, who wrote them on the day after the Lamphere verdict. The mystery that hangs about the murderous operations of Mrs. Ganes is likely to never be fully dispelled. In conception and brutality of execution, the crimes of Mrs. Ganes are unparalleled. She is entitled to be known to future generations as the arch-fiend of the 20th century.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Hell's Princess, The Mystery of Belle Ganes, Butcher of Men, by Harold Schechter, performed by Malcolm Hill Gardner. Performance copyright 2017 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc., all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.